From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross.
There's this mystery man I've been chasing for the better part of a year. Cooks the purest meth that me or anyone else has ever seen. Goes by the name of Heisenberg.
That's Dean Norris as DEA agent Hank Schrader on AMC's Breaking Bad. And who's that mystery man he's chasing who goes by the name of Heisenberg? The audience has known for a while, and in the mid-season cliffhanger, Hank figured it out as well. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Dean Norris about his role in Breaking Bad. The show returns next month for its final 8 episodes. Norris also is starring in the CBS series of the Stephen King adaptation Under the Dome. Also, film critic David Edelstein reviews the 2 new low-budget documentaries, Blackfish and The Act of Killing. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, in for Terry Gross.
Hey, well, come here, everybody, listen up. I'm gonna give a little toast to my brother-in-law. Come here. Well, you got a brain the size of Wisconsin, but we're not gonna hold that against you. But your heart's in the right place, man. Your heart's in the right place. We love you, man. We love you. Everybody, to Walt, Nostrovia.
Nostrovia.
That's a scene from the pilot of the AMC series Breaking Bad, in which today's guest, Dean Norris, plays DEA agent Hank Schrader, toasting the 50th birthday of his brother-in-law, Walter White. Breaking Bad, which was just nominated for an Emmy as Outstanding Drama Series, returns next month with the second half of its fifth and final season. At the start of the series, Walt was a high school chemistry teacher diagnosed with terminal lung cancer. To make money to leave behind for his family after he's gone, Walt started using his chemistry knowledge to cook and sell meth, the purest meth anyone can remember. Eventually, he gets involved with a cartel and turns into a gangster himself. Meanwhile, Hank, the DEA agent, is obsessed with tracking down the mystery man making this pure meth. Until the mid-season cliffhanger, Hank didn't realize it was his brother-in-law. And while Agent Schrader figures to have a pivotal role in the last episodes of Breaking Bad, Norris is also starring in a summer CBS series, Under the Dome, based on a story by Stephen King. Let's hear a scene from season 4 of Breaking Bad. The drug kingpin Walt has been cooking for wants to make sure Walt doesn't become indispensable to the operation. So the kingpin insists Walt train another chemist, Gail Bedeker, to also cook meth. But Walt wants to remain indispensable, so he has Bedeker killed. But Bedeker left behind a notebook containing the chemistry formulas for their meth. That notebook becomes evidence, and when Agent Hank Schrader gets hold of it, he goes to visit Walt, figuring Walt's chemistry knowledge will help him confirm what the complicated formulas in the book are for. Agent Schrader is assuming that Bedeker, who kept the notebook, is the genius meth cook he's been tracking, who goes by the name of Heisenberg. At this point, Hank still doesn't realize Heisenberg is really his brother-in-law, Walter White. Here's Bryan Cranston as Walter White and Dean Norris as Agent Hank Schrader.
There's this mystery man I've been chasing for the better part of a year. Cooks the purest meth that me or anyone else has ever seen. Goes by the name of Heisenberg. Yeah, pretty weird, huh? I looked him up. It was one of these physicists, one of Hitler's guys, a physicist named Werner Heisenberg. Real cute, huh? Anyway, I figure with a handle like that, you know, my guy's got to be some sort of an egghead. No offense. And here we go. Gail Major Tom Bedeker. Anyway, I just want to see if I'm you know, not barking up the wrong tree, chemically speaking. As far as I can make out, he's writing about phenylacetone cook, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty rare these days, but it does jive with the blue stuff I've been tracking.
2 sticks dairy-free soy margarine, 2/3 cup turbinado sugar.
It's a recipe for vegan s'mores. There's all kinds of crazy crap in there. You got top 10 recumbent bicycles, indoor composting tips, all right next to the mother of methamphetamine synthesis. This guy was a real character.
Yeah, he seems unique.
Hey, let me show you something. Give it here. Right here at the top says, to WW, my star, my perfect silence. WW. I mean, who you figure that is, huh? Woodrow Wilson? Willy Wonka? Walter White?
You got me.
That was Bryan Cranston as Walter White and Dean Norris as Hank Schrader in a season 4 scene from AMC's Breaking Bad. When we last saw Hank in the mid-season cliffhanger, he had just started to make the connection between Heisenberg and Walter. But when Terry Gross spoke to Dean Norris last year, Hank was still in the dark.
Dean Norris, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
So, you know, what's so interesting about that is that everyone watching this series knows that the meth cook that you're chasing is actually your brother-in-law, and you're like the only one who doesn't know.
Right.
I mean, lots of people in the series don't know, but like the whole audience knows. So what's it like for you to play something knowing that everybody watching knows a truth that you don't?
Yeah, it's a little frustrating. You know, it's interesting. It kind of goes back to that first scene you played where he... I think we as people, certainly law enforcement, they size people up rather quickly. And I think they then hold on to that opinion. And he has known Walter White for a long time, and he's only known him to be this kind of ineffectual, milquetoast kind of guy. And that's who he sees him as. So the concept of seeing him or even possibly imagining him as some sort of meth cook and a man who could function in that environment is just beyond ridiculous for Hank Schrader. And so the audience can often see and make leaps and say, wow, how come you can't figure it out? There's all these clues that it's him and blah, blah, blah. But they seem like good clues to the audience because, yes, they already know that it's him. But Hank Schrader doesn't. And it's been important to Vince Gilligan and to myself in portraying that character that we don't make him look like a stupid cop. Because then the audience loses interest in that. It's really funny because, you know, that scene is later followed by a scene where Bryan Cranston, and this is one of the things I think is one of the funny things that come along in the show, where he can't allow Gail Bedecker to take credit for being the genius. And he gets drunk, and he Hank Schrader is like just about to end the case and say, well, obviously this is the guy and he's dead, so there's no more Heisenberg. And it's Walter White who says, well, you know, maybe the genius is still out there. And it's one of those great moments, I think, where the hubris of Walter White gets him in trouble because he keeps Hank Schrader on the case.
I love watching each new episode and seeing, like, what the next character development or plot twist is going to do. When you get your new script, what's the first thing you do? Do you just immediately look for your part and see what's happening with your character, or do you read it page by page?
You know, it's changed. The first few seasons, I would read it page by page. The last couple seasons, I would first look for my character stuff, and then I kind of wanted to preserve watching the show and to see it as the audience sees it over the past couple years. So I didn't always read the entire script. I needed to know what was pertinent to my character, but I kind of wanted to be surprised and be able to watch the show as an audience member would. So I haven't read them as detailed in the past couple seasons as I have, as I did when I started.
And it's not just that you're being lazy and not reading the whole script.
No, because, I have plenty of time to read it. And I'd like to, but I've gone through this thing with Breaking Bad. I didn't really watch a whole lot of television prior to doing it. And then we started being compared to all these great shows. So I went back and I started watching The Wire and I started watching The Sopranos. And I'm like on the second season of both of those now, having just finished and looking forward to the rest of it. But I wanted to see where we fit in. And so I then developed this kind of need to want to watch Breaking Bad in a pure sense, like everybody else does, not knowing what's going on, not knowing what's going to happen, and see if I had the same reaction to the show as a lot of critics and audience members have. So that's kind of why I did it.
There's a few turning points in your character's development, and I want to ask you about one or two. There's a drug kingpin a couple of seasons ago named Tuco. He's kind of like the head of the local franchise of the Mexican meth cartel. And
right.
You have a shootout with him. He's already got a gun, a semi-automatic weapon, and you just have a handgun. But you manage to shoot him.
Right.
But after that, you start getting these anxiety attacks. And I think like your character didn't know he was capable of that level of fear. And that he didn't know he could be so shaken by either being shot at or by shooting and killing somebody, which is surprising in the sense that cops in movies and TV shows use their guns all the time,
right,
and get shot at all the time.
Yeah, I you know, it's interesting because really in truth, very few law enforcement officers in their entire career ever fire their gun in the line of duty. And when I was doing research for this, and I did a lot prior to that particular shootout because I wanted to look like I could handle the gun properly and spend a lot of time with not only DEA agents but other other law enforcement types, and it always amazed me that we would go and I'd learn to shoot a gun, and these guys would practice every week shooting at the range, every week. What would you do if you had to pull your gun in the line of duty? And I thought, man, it really must wear on you to think about that moment coming for 20 years, for 25 years, however long you're in the career, and it never happens. And then one day, boom, out of the blue, it happens. And how would you react? And that's why they train, because you're supposed to react how you train. And that's ultimately what Hank Schrader does, is he reacts well under that circumstance. And it's only later that the psychological repercussions start to affect him.
Your first movie was Lethal Weapon 2, and those Lethal Weapon mm-hmm. movies, I mean, they're just famous for, like, things are blowing up, glass is shattering, people are jumping through windows, cars are crashing, and everybody's just kind of quipping. So how do you feel about that, having portrayed now a probably much more realistic view of what it's like to encounter violence, even if you're an armed officer of the law? What do you think, looking back on weapons, on movies like Lethal Weapon, where no matter what's happening, it's time for a joke?
Right. Well, I have very fond memories. That was my very first movie, and it was a great time, and made some good money on it, and that's what turned me into an actor from being a waiter. But I can see the arguments against those types of movies. I don't know. I prefer the portrayal of law enforcement that we see with Hank Schrader, because of the fact that it's a clearer and a more truthful, I think, portrayal. And maybe you just chalk Lethal Weapon 2 movies up to what they're supposed to be, which is fun entertainment.
And what kind of waiter were you before becoming an actor?
Well, I'd gotten to L.A. With no money. And with no experience as a waiter, and immediately lied my way into a job at a local restaurant, and was there for about 6 months. And I got a phone call literally while I was at the job, saying that I had booked a Lethal Weapon 2. And I was like, "Are you sure? How much money exactly?" And now this is guaranteed, right? Yes, it's all done. I said, "Okay." Took my apron off, handed my to other waiters, this hamburger goes here, that hamburger goes there, and I left. And interestingly enough, Lethal Weapon 2 premiered in the theater next to the restaurant where I was working.
Oh, that must have felt good.
That was fun, yeah.
Actor Dean Norris speaking to Terry Gross last year. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2012 interview with actor Dean Norris, who plays Hank, Walter White's DEA agent brother-in-law on the AMC series Breaking Bad. It returns next month for its final 8 episodes.
There's another scene that's a turning point for your character that I want to talk about. And this is a scene where you're assigned to work with border agents, on the Mexican border. And so you're in the desert with a bunch of your fellow DEA agents. And something's approaching you from the distance, and you see it's a very large tortoise, and on the tortoise's shell is a decapitated head. It's the head of somebody who had been an informant for the DEA. And the cartel has written a message on the tortoise's shell that says, "Hola, DEA," which is, "Hello, DEA." Yeah. And all the DEA agents are kind of laughing at what a spectacle this is. But you're positively revolted. Your legs start to buckle. It looks like you're ready to heave. You kind of wobbly walk back to your car where you try to regain your composure. And after you've moved away from the scene, one of the other agents lifts the head off the tortoise, and it turns out that the head's been booby-trapped, and there's a huge explosion. All the agents are either killed or mutilated, except you, because you are so revolted by this that you'd walked away. So what was your reaction when you first read the scene? Did you think that this was almost like so over the top that the writer must have been fooling you?
No, I read that scene and I was just, it was, to me, it was prototypical Breaking Bad.
I should point out, too, there's been so many decapitations in by the cartels. I suppose in some ways it's really not even that unrealistic.
Right. And it fit, I think it was great because, what, in fact, the reason he was, it was part of his PTSD that we were talking about earlier, his post-traumatic stress syndrome, that we didn't really quite know what it was. But that, in fact, is what saved his life, the fact that he couldn't deal with all the stuff that was going on with this, you know, this decapitated head in front of him. And I thought that, you know, in any other script, in any other show, because you don't really reveal that there's a head on that turtle until you get down there. You see Hank Schrader go, you know, eyes go wide, like something crazy is going on. We all rush down there, and it's, oh, my goodness, that's the big reveal. Is that, wow, it's a turtle with a head on it. That would be good enough for most shows. But it's sort of like Spinal Tap, you know, we go to 11. Not only is there a turtle with a head on it, but we pull it up and it blows up. I thought it was brilliant.
So there's another scene, another violent scene that I want to ask you about because it's another really big turning point for your character.
Yeah.
You're in your car, it's parked, and you get a call on your cell phone saying, from you don't know who, you're not even sure if it's a prank or for real, saying that there are two guys coming to get you and they will be there in 1 minute. And you don't know what to do. You know, you call the person who you think is pranking you. He doesn't answer the phone. You get the voicemail message. You have a digital clock that the camera's looking at in your car. And we see the full 60 seconds of you just not knowing what to do, and you're just kind of frozen and nervous and looking around, and everybody who's walking past the car, you're thinking, are they the killer? No, they're not the killer. Is that the killer? Is there a killer? And then a few seconds after the minute elapses, two shooters from the drug cartel are there with guns to avenge their cousin's murder. Would you describe the scene from your perspective?
Yeah, that was, you know, it's turned out to kind of, that scene has kind of taken on a life of its own in this Breaking Bad series. It's one of the scenes that really kind of defined that season. It was an amazing thing to shoot. We shot that in 2 days. A film would have taken, you know, 2 weeks to shoot that scene. There were no words other than when I first make the phone call to my partner Gomi. There were virtually no words in a 5-minute scene, so it was all done by, you know, by our eyes and being worried and being scared. And the director literally just would talk me through the scene, would put the cameras on, and she'd be like, you know, look scared, look left, look right, looks really scared. Now you're relaxed a little more. Now you're really, really, really scared. And it was an amazing scene to do. And when the shootout came, that was something as well, because there's all, you know, if you're in the car, in order to make the glass break as if it's been shot by a bullet, there's actually it's essentially a gun that's on the inside of the car that shoots out. And if you happen to get your hand in front of that, you know, it wouldn't be very pleasant. And it's a very tense situation. There's a lot of cameras going. There's a lot of money being spent. And you know, you have to make sure you don't move this way, move that way. Don't move your head too far that way. You got to feel the bullet coming in. And there's all these things going on. And they're like, okay, ready now. The most important thing is let's have safety. You know? And they're ready, action. And you're like, oh, man. And so there's all these external things that are going on. And you're just trying to stay in this character's head. So it was a really challenging and fun thing to shoot. I didn't have a sense of how that scene would resonate until we really saw it in the finished product, because they put that scene together in just a phenomenal way. Something about that scene, even if you know the ending of that scene, you can still watch it and you'll get chills right up to the end.
When you say, and then you had to feel the bullet coming in, what exactly did you mean?
Well, you know, you have squibs on you that are going to blow up, so you have to
explain what a squib is.
Well, a squib is a small explosive device that they put on your shirt that's going to explode with some blood. And it's a little pinch, you know, it's a little, so you get some kind of help there. But you have to time you feeling that hit, being shot by the bullet at the same time that the technical guy on the side is going to press the button so that it explodes. So you have to, and I had like three hits all in one sequence. And then there's other stuff going on. I'm putting the car in reverse. I'm you know, crawling out of the car. There's all kinds of things going on. And that all happens, you know, in one time. And we did several takes of it, but that take includes getting hit three times. So you have to go, boom, I got a hit in the arm, boom, I got a hit in the back, boom. At the same time, you want to make sure you don't put your hand or your face anywhere near the gun that's going to be exploding out the window. At the same time, you're putting in reverse and you don't want to hit the crew guys that are only 2 feet from the car or the guy that's behind you. And there's all these things that are going on, and you have to kind of keep your wits about you. But at the same time, you're portraying a character who is just, you know, scared and just reacting and moving. So it's a challenging thing to shoot.
Was there an ambulance waiting off camera, just in case?
There is. Yeah,
seriously?
There is, actually.
Really?
Seriously, yeah. There's a, well, there's paramedics around, sure.
So does that make you feel secure or terrified?
Yeah, then, you know, luckily I had done Lethal Weapon 2 and a bunch of those types of shows over the years, so I felt a little bit better about doing it.
Dean Norris speaking to Terry Gross in 2012. We'll continue their conversation in the second half of the show. I'm David B. Cooley, and this is Fresh Air.
Walking out for love. I'm walking out really down in a cool breeze. I'm gonna be late again. Driver, wait for me, please. I'm running all in vain, trying to catch this train. Time don't fool me no more. I throw my watch to the floor.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Angie's List, providing reviews of local roofers, painters, landscapers, and plumbers to keep the consumer informed. More at angieslist.com. From the Cy Sims Foundation, supporting advances in science, education, and the arts since 1985. CySimsFoundation.org. And from Chevrolet, maker of the Volt, with electric technology to get there and fuel to go farther. Details at ChevyVolt.com. This is NPR. Coming up, more with Dean Norris about portraying DEA agent Hank Schrader in the AMC series Breaking Bad. Also, David Edelstein reviews two new documentaries. There's Blackfish, about the whale that killed a trainer at Orlando's SeaWorld in 2010, and The Act of Killing, about the mass executions of communists in Indonesia in the 1960s.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David B. Cooley, in for Terry Gross, back with more of Terry's interview with Dean Norris. He's starring this summer in a new CBS series, Under the Dome, based on a Stephen King story. But when Terry spoke with Dean Norris last year, the conversation focused on the AMC series Breaking Bad, which returns next month for its highly anticipated final 8 episodes. Norris stars as DEA agent Hank Schrader, who is tracking down a master meth cook, not realizing it's his brother-in-law, former high school chemistry teacher Walter White. When we left off, Dean Norris and Terry were talking about the scene in which Norris's character, Hank, is attacked by two men from a Mexican drug cartel.
So we were talking about being shot in a scene, and you're shot several times, and you nearly die, but you emerge from that unable to use your legs. And you do very, very slowly start to recover, but it's a long process, and you have no idea if you will ever, early on, you have no idea if you will ever regain any movement from your legs. And you've already been very moody because you've been suffering with these anxiety bouts, post-traumatic stress as a result of having been shot at and shot a man in an earlier episode. So you're lying in bed a lot. You're really depressed. You're bitter. You're angry. And even your wife, Marie, who's trying so hard to like cheer you up and encourage you, every time she comes into the room, you just like find a reason to insult her. So I want to play an example of that. So you've been in physical therapy and you're starting to make a little bit of progress. And progress is basically charted by the number of steps you can take every day. And it's just a few. So in this scene, you're in bed after your physical therapy. And your wife, Marie, comes home. She's just spoke to the therapist. Marie's acting very upbeat about the progress you've been making in physical therapy.
How was PT? I heard it was very good. I'm really liking this new therapist. He keeps me in the loop, always has time for a phone call. I like it. So, tell me all about it. I heard you broke new ground today.
I broke new ground?
That's what he said. Tell me.
I walked 16 feet in 20 minutes, which is up from like 15 and a half yesterday. And I had maybe this much less in my pants. So yeah, Marie, if you and him and everybody else in America secretly took a vote and changed the meaning of the entire English language, yeah, I guess I broke new ground.
What did you do to prepare for being weakened, being sick, being unable to use your legs, and being in despair about your physical state of being and your future?
Yeah.
And being dependent in the way that you are. I mean, right after that, your wife helps you with the bedpan. Which you clearly find that like so humiliating. And your response, of course, is always to just insult her and be really cold to her.
Yeah, that was a tough season. I gotta be honest with you. You know, you can only wear like a mask so long before it really starts to kind of affect who you are. And I remember talking to Bryan Cranston one time and saying how frustrated I was with how the season was going. He's like, well, you're just kind of, there's just too much Hank left in you. You gotta let it go. It's to take that character who had been so robust. I mean, that's, you know, partly or largely what defined Hank Schrader in the first two seasons, and then to completely take away all his physicality in the sense of he can't walk and his wife has to wipe his butt and change his bedpan for him. It was tough. And I talked to some people, tried to get a sense of what it's like to be disabled, and that it's tough, particularly when it first happens to you, you know. And it was a depressing place to be. And yeah, he did take it out on his wife, but that's the only person he had there to take anything out on. So he looked kind of bad as a character. But I think it. Hopefully, at the end of the day, you understood where he was coming from. But it was a depressing, both as an actor and kind of as a person. It kind of took it out of me that season.
So I think it was the season before the episode that we've just been talking about that your father had a stroke, and I don't think he lived long after that. And I'm wondering, if you don't mind my asking, if he was in physical therapy after that, and if you watched him try to hang in there and having lost a lot of physical ability afterwards.
Yeah, he didn't go into physical therapy, but seeing, you know, your father, basically in a hospital bed for several months, certainly was something that I couldn't help but not draw on.
Were you shooting at the time that he was in the hospital?
I was the whole time, yeah.
So
it was and Vince was very kind to give me certain episodes off when I needed it and things like that. So it was it worked out that way.
If you don't mind my asking, only because so many people are in this position between, you know, balancing the work that they're obligated or committed to doing and visiting, you know, a parent or a spouse or a child who's very sick in the hospital, how did you figure out how much time was okay to be away from the set and how much time you could spend by your father's side?
Yeah, that was a constant issue. My dad, who was the first guy who kind of taught me about entertainment, he was a singer in a band, and we had a very, very good relationship. I really loved my dad, and he and my mom were big fans of the entertainment business, and they always the first ones to teach me and would always tell me that the show must go on. And I think that's one of the great things about the entertainment business, that one of the great basic concepts of show business is the show must go on. I think that's a good lesson for life. So I kind of took that and did what I did. I had when I needed to be on the set, I got there. There were a few times I would, you know, Vince said, "Hey, it's not that important for you to be in this particular episode, so we can write you out and give you a whole week off." And I took that with much appreciation, and just had to do it. Had to figure between the two. So. At the end of the day, the show does have to go on, and I made it to the set and did my job.
So this season, there's a birthday party for Walt. And Walt explains that it was just about exactly 1 year ago that he was diagnosed with cancer, which means that all the stories that have taken place in all of Breaking Bad over the past four seasons and several episodes has really happened in 1 year. So it's happened over more than 4 years in terms of actual television viewing time. Was it 4 or 5 years or maybe even more because some of the seasons get so delayed? But, you know, when you go back to the first season, everybody looks like so much younger, like, you know, way more than a year has elapsed. So have you guys been thinking about that? Because it's so funny to think that what we've seen as several years and several seasons is supposed to have just happened in 1 year.
Yeah, we think about that a lot, and we have to remind ourselves, too, because you kind of get involved in it, and we look back and go, wait a minute, in real time, in terms of, not real time, but I guess in fictional time, this has only been 6 months, it's only been 8 months, and we're constantly reminded about that by the producers and directors. Yeah, it is interesting. Look, they did 24 over 22 episodes, and that was one day, so. Oh, and as Bryan Cranston and Vince Gilligan like to say, the MASH, you know, the Korean War, MASH lasted a lot longer than the Korean War did. So,
right. This season, there was a great scene where Walt and his teenage son are in the living room in front of the TV watching Al Pacino in a scene from Scarface. And Walt's wife, who is just, she just really hates Walt at this point because he just keeps getting deeper and deeper into the meth business and into his gangster self. And she thinks that even though he feels secure and that they're safe, that they're not, and that her children are endangered. So to make the scene even worse, when she walks in and Walt and their teenage boy are watching Scarface, Walt has their infant on his lap.
Yeah.
Which leads me to wonder, how old do your kids have to be before they watch Breaking Bad?
Well, I'm probably not going to win Dad of the Year. I don't let them watch Breaking. I don't let them watch. I have younger kids, and I have let them watch the show before. I don't let them watch anything where it looks like I might die. I'm not sure they'd be able to deal with that, but I have let them watch the show. Like I said, I'm not sure this is the right thing to do. My middle son has seen and my older son have both seen the Tuco shootout scene. I think you need to be well into your teens, probably, as a general rule, to watch the show.
You've played a lot of cops in your time. Hank is a DEA agent. Your first movie was Lethal Weapon 2. You've been in like CSI TV shows. What is it about you?
Well, you know, if you stop in any donut shop and you see three cops eating donuts, man, one of them's gonna look like me. I don't know why that is, but I'm about one in three. I guess it's just, you know, you have a certain look, and it's kind of an authoritative law enforcement type look, and that look is certainly the first thing that that people cast you with before you get a chance to do some acting and do some other stuff. Like now, I'm getting more dad roles and doing some different stuff. I just played a used car salesman in a little movie that I like, and getting some opportunities to do different things than just cops.
Actor Dean Norris speaking to Terry Gross last year. In addition to his role as DEA agent Hank Schrader on the AMC cable series Breaking Bad, he's also starring currently in the CBS drama Under the Dome, based on the Stephen King bestseller. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2012 interview with actor Dean Norris, who plays Hank, Walter White's DEA agent brother-in-law, on the AMC series Breaking Bad. It returns next month for its final 8 episodes.
So you grew up in South Bend, Indiana. Was your father a salesman, or did he own the furniture store?
Yeah, he owned a furniture store. That was his day job, and then he had a band that he played every Friday and Saturday night
for
as long
as
I can remember. It was just like a variety band. They would play at various bar, restaurant type places, weddings and that kind of thing. And he just loved it. And I used to play with them when I got old enough, and it was really where I learned had a great love for entertainment.
What kind of music?
Covers of rock songs, covers of classics, Sinatra type stuff, things like that.
And what did you play when you played with them?
I played guitar, and I also sang, and then I had my own band later, any number of bands, and it was really just a great, great time. And my dad, it's funny, my dad always used to talk about himself as he couldn't read music, he didn't, finish high school, but he was really, really a good entertainer. He had a very nice voice, but he never considered himself a singer. He always considered himself an entertainer, and he kind of drilled that into me that's what, when people come there to see him, they don't necessarily come to hear a great voice. They come to be kind of taken away for 3 hours, and that's what he would do.
Hmm. How did you decide?
I think that's important in acting, by the way.
Yeah. How did you decide you wanted to act?
Well, I'd been doing it since I was 5 in church plays and things like that, and did a lot of it in college. It was a tough decision because I went to Harvard, and I was the first kid in my family to go to college. My parents didn't go to college, really, in my extended family, even with my cousins and stuff. So it was at one level, you're like, wow, here's the lottery out of the lower middle class by getting this ticket into Harvard. And I had a choice to either go into investment banking or pursue acting. And I talked to a lot of people. I'd done some plays with the American Repertory Theater there in Boston, so I had other professional actors who were making a living, and would have been able to talk to them, ask them what they thought my chances were, things like that. I really, really tried to look at hard, because so many people decide they're going to become an actor, and you go, well, how, are you one of those guys who's deceiving yourself into thinking you have a chance of doing this, or do you really have a chance of doing it? So I really kind of examined that question long and hard. And ultimately, I was doing, you play small parts at the American Repertory Theater that they would give to the students, and I figured these guys all made a living, they didn't make as much money, let's say, as someone on TV or on film. But I said, I'm standing backstage in some tights and a codpiece, watching grown men, on stage. And it was just electric. And there's 800 people out there. And it was just something magical about being, backstage, ready to go on stage. And you got all your colleagues are out there. And I said, man, if this is as good as it gets, if I could do this the rest of my life, be a repertory actor, I'd be a happy man. And I said, okay, so let's do it.
So with Breaking Bad, you've gotten a leading role on TV, and it's relatively late in your career. What's it like to have such a prominent part on TV now, after having seen people you knew get there much earlier in life?
Yeah, I've always thought that I would be a middle-aged actor. You know, I got out here. I think I did Lethal Weapon 2. That was my first, decent job. I think I was 25 already, but I was always playing 10 years older than I was because I was losing my hair and I just had that kind of look. So I was always playing 35-year-olds when I was 25, and always playing 45-year-olds when I was 35. And I always felt when I got into my mid to late 30s, that would be the time where I would be playing characters that fit who I was. And I think different people have, people who kind of hit their peak when they're young. And I have no complaints. I made a really good living. I never did anything else but acting. And since that time, 25, and compared to certainly what my parents made, or most of the people I grew up with made, or even people out here who had really good jobs as doctors and lawyers. I mean, I made a pretty good, because I worked consistently, made a pretty good amount of money, and felt that I would always kind of had made it, because every year I put on my IRS form, entertainment. But it is interesting. I mean, I kind of would rather be having all this stuff happening now than having had it happen at 25 and not happen again.
Right.
And I do think that my look allows me. I'm looking at another 20 years of looking of these types of roles. So that's not bad.
Dean Norris, it's been great to talk with you. Love you in Breaking Bad. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Actor Dean Norris speaking to Terry Gross in 2012. He currently stars in the CBS series Under the Dome and co-stars in AMC's Breaking Bad, which returns next month for its final 8 episodes. Dicen que es color azul y que es pura calidad. Esa droga poderosa que circula en la ciudad. Y los dueños de la plaza no la pudieron parar. Tenían la plaza del Duke, el Tuco y el Crazy Eight. Al Tuco le dieron piso manejando su Escalade. Un poco antes los gabachos quebraron al Crazy Eight. Anda caliente el cartel, al respeto le faltaron. Hablan de un tal Heisenberg que ahora controla el mercado. Nadie sabe nada de él porque nunca lo han mirado. El cartel es de respeto y jamás ha perdonado. Ese compa ya está muerto. No más no le han avisado. That's a Narco Corrido, a drug ballad celebrating Heisenberg, the gringo drug kingpin. It opened a previous episode of Breaking Bad. Coming up, film critic David Edelstein reviews two new documentaries, Blackfish and The Act of Killing. This is Fresh Air. Film critic David Edelstein has a review of two new attention-getting documentaries, The first, by Gabriella Copperthwaite, is called Blackfish and centers on the whale that killed a trainer in front of an audience at SeaWorld in Orlando in 2010. SeaWorld has mounted an aggressive campaign in response, accusing the film of being inaccurate, misleading, and shamefully dishonest. The second film, The Act of Killing, by Texas-born human rights researcher Josh Oppenheimer, looks back on the mass killings of communists in Indonesia in the 1960s.
Two documentaries, Blackfish and The Act of Killing, are making waves around the world. The first riles you up. The second blows your mind. Blackfish is the Inuit's name for orca, the killer whale, a creature they say is worthy of veneration, but you don't want to mess with. The chief example in Gabriella Copperthwaite's Blackfish being Tilikum, responsible for 2, possibly 3 human deaths. The movie is Tilikum's story, along with the story of other whales kept in captivity in theme parks like SeaWorld. Tilikum was snatched from his mother early, and a mother whale that loses a child makes sounds that transcend species. You hear mother's cries in Blackfish, which opens with a description by one participant and one researcher of a 1970 hunt for young whales.
It was a really exciting thing to do until everybody wanted to do it.
What were they telling you you were going to do?
Capture orcas.
They had aircraft, they had spotters, they had speedboats, they had bombs they were throwing in the water. They were lighting their bombs with acetylene torches in their boats and throwing them as fast as they could to herd the whales into coves. But the orcas had been caught before, and they knew what was going on, and they knew their young ones would be taken from them. So the adults without young went east into cul-de-sac, and the boats followed them, thinking they were all going that way, while the mothers with babies went north. But the capture teams had aircraft, and they have to come up for air eventually. And when they did, the capture teams alerted the boats and said, oh no, they're going north, the ones with babies. So the boats, the speedboats, caught them there and herded them in. And then they had fishing boats with seine nets that they would stretch across so none could leave, and then they could just pick out the young ones.
That sequence is almost too upsetting to watch, and Blackfish gets yet more painful. Whales have been shown to be complex, emotional beings, and former Orlando SeaWorld trainers recall the anguish of mother-child separations and the obvious psychological impact of captivity. The ex-trainers' tearful, sometimes shame-filled recollections alternate with footage of their younger selves smiling and declaiming for SeaWorld audiences, doing tricks with whales they came to love. They even loved Tilikum, whose mutilation of esteemed trainer Don Branchow in 2010 sent SeaWorld into PR overdrive, the company claiming she was grabbed by a ponytail she shouldn't have left dangling. Witnesses in Blackfish make a more compelling case that she was attacked. Her death is thankfully not shown, although the movie is not for the squeamish. SeaWorld officials who declined to be interviewed for the film are calling it inaccurate and misleading. Meanwhile, Tilikum remains at SeaWorld, though is, in the words of one researcher, psychotic. He's valuable breeding material, though. His semen is worth millions. Josh Oppenheimer's The Act of Killing centers on the massacre in Indonesia in the mid-60s of communists and suspected communists. Estimates of the dead vary. It could have been 1 million. Most were executed by paramilitaries in league with then-general, future president Suharto. And the killers are still there, unpunished, even honored. And they love movies, especially gangster movies. So when Oppenheimer approached them to make a film, to help write and direct their life stories, even put on makeup and costumes and reenact scenes, they agreed with enthusiasm. They even participated in flabbergasting songs and dances, big production numbers. With the film's release, some subjects have backpedaled, saying they misunderstood the project. What we see, though, leaves little room for misunderstanding. The principal subject is Anwar Kongo, leader of an elite death unit. He can look grandfatherly in one shot, hard in the next. He loves Hollywood gangsters. He says the word gangster means free man. Anwar boasts of designing ways to kill people with thin wires to keep blood from spurting. But he's also having nightmares about his victims. On the other hand, a former colleague of his named Adi Zulkadri has no patience for guilt. He's a relativist. War crimes, he says, are defined by the winners. He refuses to be branded a war criminal. Both men demonstrate interrogation, torture, and killing. In one case, with a man playing someone resembling his own murdered stepfather. A reenactment of a massacre and the burning of a village features women and children who can't stop sobbing long after the director has yelled, "Cut!" Most of what we see is bizarre to the point of trippiness, but the act of killing documents a higher reality. By allowing murderers to write, direct, and perform, Oppenheimer not only puts the horror in the present tense, he also shows you how these men viewed their actions, the myths they told themselves and one another. It's one of the most lucid portraits of evil I've ever seen.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. You can download podcasts of our show at freshair.npr.org. And follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air and on Tumblr at nprfreshair.tumblr.com. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hirschfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Nell Beschenstein. Roberta Sharrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm David B. Inculli.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Epic Records, presenting the new album, The Blessed Unrest by Sarah Bareilles, featuring the anthem Brave, available now at Starbucks. From the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting solutions to prevent and end homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org. And from the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of edutopia.org, a source for inspiration and information about what works in education. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with David Kirkpatrick, New York Times Cairo bureau chief. He arrived in the region just before the start of the Arab Spring, covered the Egyptian Revolution, and now he's been reporting on the military's ouster of Egypt's first democratically elected president. Join us.